Welcome to the MacGuffin. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James.
Sup?
He's in a colder locale than me, apparently. He seems can't stop complaining about it. But check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We've got a lot of older podcasts. We most recently discussed A Most Violent Year, which is a movie we both liked. And I recently wrote about Kendrick Lamar's new album, which was cool. And yeah, you can find all of our older work there as well. So themacguffinmen.com. Also follow us on Twitter at themacguffinmen if Twitter is a thing you do and you're okay with us only tweeting like once a week. But yeah, everyone counts. So we put a lot of effort into them. We don't actually. I'm very tired. I'm sorry. Anyway, theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James, what are we talking about today?
Oh man. A movie of many titles. Sorry, a film of many titles. Fast and Furious 7.
Yes.
This is pretty much just going to be our Most Violent Year podcast over again,
Oh,
I
exactly.
think.
It's a lot of discussion of ability and morality again.
Deliberate filmmaking in this.
Yeah.
This
A lot of Oscar Isaac. A lot of characters you're unsure of their ethnicity as well.
Was the Fast and Furious 6 podcast a mini-sode as well?
I don't know. I think maybe I did we do a podcast on Fast Five? I feel like we must have at some point, right?
This
we're killing the beginning of this one,
yeah,
man.
really. No, this
Let's talk about our personal lives like other shitty
well, this one's for the diehards anyway.
Yeah, good point.
Minisodes.
The John McClanes, if you will.
Yes. The John Allisters, if you will.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, this has been an interesting series for us, our relationship to the Fast and Furious movies.
There are still some of these movies you haven't seen, right?
Tokyo Drift and Too Fast, Too Furious.
Oh, Too Fast is a gem.
They're all gems in their own way, aren't they?
It's a more complicated question than I think you think.
Yeah, I mean, for anyone who didn't listen to those other podcasts that may or may not exist, can you describe
Hold
your
on, I'll turn on God's Eye and see if we can find them.
Historical God's Eye. Can you describe your relationship slash level of appreciation for the series and why you wanted to do this episode?
Yes. Didn't like the first one. Second one was an amazing intentional comedy that I saw back-to-back nights in theaters. Tokyo Drift is underrated, but still not great. Fast and Furious 4 has one really, really great sequence. Fast 5 is an action classic, and Fast 6 is a very enjoyable action film. You know, and the reason I want the series to continue to be good and continue to exist and continue making a lot of people happy, sorry, not a lot of people, one person, me, because Fast 5 is just so goddamn good, and those movies just don't exist very frequently. And I think the most enjoyable experiences I get at the movies, not necessarily the most I don't know, thoughtful or interesting, but certainly the most enjoyable experiences are things like Fast Five, where you can so sort of just be like, holy shit, this is amazing, you know? And and just like in the moment you recognize how cool things are, and the climax is just the best thing in the world, that safe chase. It's so good. But yeah.
And where does this one fall in your rankings? And do you think it's doing those things that you like about the series?
No.
That's where it ranks as a no.
Yeah. I don't know. I have a lot of problems with the direction of this movie, and you could kind of see it going this way on six. I'm sure we talked about it, how there was much more of a Superman angle to Fast 6. Part of what made Fast 5 so cool is that The Rock was just a Superman, and that's fine, because he looks like a Superman, you
Yeah,
know?
where it's not true, that's not true of Dwayne Johnson in real life. So.
I haven't seen proof of that. But yeah, and it was cool because it was still, you know, there's nothing really superhuman that Brian or Dom or anybody does other than The Rock in Fast Five. And so there's still some sort of element of stakes, right? And part of what makes Fast Five so good still is that it ramps up its craziness throughout the movie, which is why it slowly builds to you being okay with them towing that giant safe through Rio and demolishing a bridge.
More okay than the citizens of Rio de Janeiro, surely.
Yeah. But as we learned from Fast Five, nobody gives a fuck about the citizens of Rio. And in Fast Six, there's a very early moment where The Rock just jumps from a building on top of a car and just sticks the landing. And Vin does a super, his Jesus jump to catch Letty. And, you know, there was always building to a point where this series was going to, everybody was going to be too super. And that's this movie.
the only stakes in the last two have been at the garage cookouts.
There wasn't even a garage cookout in this one.
Which is sad to me because, these movies have a few things each one does, like right down to the wardrobe of the last scene.
Yeah.
And I mean, that one had this one had that, right. But
yeah. I suspect the original ending of this movie ends with a barbecue at the house, the rebuilt house, the end of Batman Begins, if you will.
Right.
Yeah. But once one of their family members died, they had to let the family home die too.
Yeah. And
hashtag for Paul.
Yeah. Yeah, this movie, I believe, looks a lot different than it would have had Paul Walker survived to the very end.
Yes.
And then to the end of the filming, I mean. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's very famously he was CGI'd into the rest of this movie, and his brothers were used to finish out the film, because he pretty much, what I understand is he died pretty much at the halfway mark of making this movie.
Yeah.
And so they, you know, they had to work around it. And do you know what the original ending was going to be?
I do not, actually. That's okay. Just kind of my guess is that I know Fast Six ends in the same way, but, you know, getting everybody together and rebuilding the house, I think, would have been a metaphor that Vin would have jumped all over.
Yeah, building the family house together.
That type of subtle metaphor Vin Diesel is known for. In his producerial work.
Yeah. I mean, I think subtle is a good word to describe everything about Vin Diesel.
Yeah. And he definitely spells it SUTTLE.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
With a sip of Corona in between the two T's.
Yeah.
Do we know what this movie's even called? Is that
It's Furious 7. This one has been promoted as Furious 7. The title card is Furious 7. And we talked about this confusion with Furious 6 because it was promoted as Fast 6 and then the title card said Furious 6. And we were both collectively like, what the fuck, when we talked about it. And you mentioned that in junkets and stuff, the actual actors didn't really know how they were supposed to refer to the movie. But yeah, this is Furious 7 the whole way through. But, you know, I mean, just because it's the title of a movie doesn't... We all call Tokyo Drift 3 Fast, 3 Furious, you know?
We do. Of course we do. Yeah.
No, I said we did, like, at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. 7 Fast, 7 Furious just isn't fun to say.
Yeah, this series has always really fascinated for me for kind of what a successful mess it is. Like, how little direction this series seemed to have at times, mm-hmm. and still... is very successful. And I mean, this one, the most recent one, Furious 7, is making a ton of money and will continue to. And the last few have done pretty well, and I think much better than I ever would have thought. Even as much fun as I did have at Fast 5, I didn't know the whole world was going to get down with it the way that it did. And it certainly has. But the naming of the movies has, as we discussed, has been very unique and not really followed a template. And is it going to be Furious 8? Do you think we're stuck on Furious Forever?
No, they just got to
wait. I think I accidentally just titled the next movie Furious Forever.
No, they just have to continually shorten the title, so it's just going to be like Fat 8 or something. Like, they're not going to use whole words anymore. Yeah.
It's got to become faster every time.
Or they're going to do the entire title in leet speak. And nobody's going to know what to call it.
I think by number 11, it's just the sound of an American muscle car revving. yeah, I mean, when I say kind of lack of direction, I mean, the naming of the series, as we discussed, has kind of been very unique for a movie that had to get to 7 to kind of figure out what it was doing, and we're still not sure.
Yeah, and it has, like, as a franchise, it's been very fly by the seat of its pants. It's not, and I, that was just the way franchise started in 2001, I think, which is when the first movie comes out. It's that, you know, they never counted on a second one making the first one, whereas now you count on the fifth one when you make the first one. And so, you know, after the first Fast and Furious movie, Vin Diesel wasn't locked in for a second. So he didn't have to be in the second if he didn't want to, and he wanted to do Triple X. Paul Walker didn't want to do the third. Vince still didn't want to do the third until the last 5 minutes of the movie. So they didn't do it, and they thought the name could still make the money. So there we go. We still got a third Fast and Furious movie that has very little to do with the previous two. And then the fourth one, Paul Walker and Vin Diesel's careers had not gone as they had initially anticipated. So they brought the whole gang back, and, you know, it kind of built to where we are today. Yeah. It has all been very, let's see who we have access to in the next movie, basically.
Yeah. And by the time we get to Fast Five, it's really not a street racing movie anymore. Like the series had been. It's basically a heist movie with a couple gratuitous car racing scenes,
yeah,
and actors from those other movies. I mean, there still is a focus on cars and things like that, but we've really got away from the illegal street racing scene as the focal point of the movie.
The race wars, if you will.
yeah, that's always what I mean by race wars.
yes, I agree. And I think you see it in the fourth movie where, you know, it's kind of there's a lot of Paul Walker as a cop in that movie, from my recollection, and a lot of the criminal syndicate that half kills Letty, I guess. I don't know what to call it. But, you know, yeah, there's progressively, with each movie starting with 4, they really have minimized the street racer.
Yeah, and there certainly was the other thing about this movie, this series, is just the timing of, like, the chronology of these movies. Like, we're finally covering new ground with the next movie. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, we're actually caught up to what has been established now. I mean, Han dies.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, spoiler, like, alert.
in this movie, we have caught up. Like, basically, once Han dies, we're in the modern time period, yes?
Yeah, but that's what I mean. Like,
or sorry, I guess when Vin Diesel goes to Tokyo, that's when.
Yeah, I just mean, like, when we start this movie, we're still not caught up to what has been established in the previous movies.
Yeah.
It feels like by the end of this movie, they are, you know, really starting anew or anything. And I don't just mean because of Paul Walker's actual death. I just mean it's really just kind of, it's figured out now. Like, they can finally do new things. Like, they've covered everything, so they can uncover some new ground. It seems like they might have the titling under control. And I think just
nothing is under control in these movies.
Yeah, that's
if there's
true.
One lesson all of these movies should have taught you, it's that the universe is inherently uncontrollable.
Right. The deep thesis of all these, yeah, movies.
The only thing you can count on is that you can't count on anything.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I feel like they have control of it now. Maybe, again, wrong word, but they kind of know what they can do with it now. And, you know, we've caught up with the chronology. I think Fast Five was not a fluke, but just a really big surprise. And it was really, really big. And just kind of researching this again and like this film and looking over the series, critics like Fast Five. Like,
oh, yeah, because it's a really well-made action movie. And, like, the dirty little secret about action movies is that when you do it right, critics love it. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Like, it's you know, they can easily look down on the 98% of it that's garbage, and then that top 2% really, really gets elevated.
Yeah.
So 5 was big. I think 6 was kind of proving that front wasn't a streak. And I know, I don't think 6 or 7 are as good as 5. But I mean, it proved that it wasn't a streak and that they can keep making these really big movies and putting a lot of money into it and getting way more of that money back.
Yeah.
So I think 6 proved that it wasn't a streak. and 6 and 7 were announced together, I mean, I think they really knew what they had on their hands and how they could do it.
Yeah, well, this movie would have been out last summer, which would have been a year after after 6, which is also why Justin Lin left the franchise. And yeah, it would have been just barely over a year when Furious 7 came out if Paul Walker didn't die.
Yeah, and so, and I think, I mean, that's a bit of a, I mean, not to take this too lightly, but I think Paul Walker's death was definitely a hiccup, definitely really sidetracked the series. And I mean, just threw them a curveball of how they were going to make it. Like, it really seemed like the ball was really rolling. They could make these movies quickly. They could make them for a lot of money. They could release one every summer and have a good action summer movie moneymaker. And Paul Walker's death doesn't stop that by any means, but I think it just kind of really brings things to a halt in the production sense. And it certainly did with this individual movie. And we're going to see more Fast and Furious movies, even without Paul Walker, because as central as he was to the series, he's not the one that made the series. You know what I mean? Like, as you said, his career really didn't blow up outside of the series, which I think goes to say, I mean, maybe a lot of people are going to hate me for saying this, he's not a fantastic actor.
He's not a good actor.
Yeah, and he's not the reason that these movies picked up in the end. You know what I mean? It wasn't him missing that this franchise flagged a little bit from after he left to five.
One thing I will say about Paul Walker, I think this movie really lacks. I think, you know, so had he not died, this movie would have been more engaging, because this movie really misses the moments where Paul Walker can goof around with people, because that's the thing he's good at, and that's the thing he started to figure out pretty much around Fast Five, was to just accept that he shouldn't try too hard as an actor and just pick his moments. And the thing that he's really good at doing is that sort of like casual, like joking, like cracking on his friends sort of thing, like the No Knees Denise joke in this movie. That's Paul Walker at his I guess his best. And like, those are the things that are in Fast Five and Fast Six and are good, that there's very little of in this movie. And that, combined with the fact that Han is no longer in these movies, who I think Furious 7 really misses Han, partially because Walker isn't there to pick up the slack in most of it. But yeah, I think there's really one more sort of like charming, likable person that this movie misses, and that is a role that Paul Walker really filled in these movies. And you're right, he's not a good actor, and his monologues with me are never the high points of the movie, although except the discussion about family with Dom and Fast Five that fucking makes me laugh so hard every time. But yeah, his solo moments are never the most important part of the movie, but what he really does bring is a casualness and a comfort to the group scenes, which is very important, and I think kind of lacks in parts of this movie.
Yeah, and as I said earlier, they did use his brothers and CGI to fill out the role of Brian Connor, Paul Walker's character.
Brian O'Connor, I believe, isn't it?
Is it Brian O'Connor? Okay.
I don't know. Who gives a shit?
Paul Walker. Yeah. And Caleb Walker. No. I couldn't tell what was what. And then I kind of read over the synopsis again with someone pointing out when they did use it and didn't. And I think the effects are, at least of that part, was done perfectly. Like, I couldn't tell. But what you lose in that is, you know, what you're saying, like that ability to ad lib. And these are people who really have done a lot of movies together over more than a decade and have got to know each other well. And some of these people, like Tyrese and Paul Walker, I think are very just naturally charismatic, entertaining people. Tyrese more so than anybody else, I feel, because he's very funny. But even if you can emulate Paul Walker's face perfectly, like, you don't get those ad libs. You don't get that kind of that friendship that does come through. So even though I think they do the visual, like, put him in there visually effectively, you do lose that charisma and that banter, as you were saying.
Yeah, exactly. And there are a couple moments where it's really clear, like no moment clearer than when they first come back to LA and they're all standing out looking at the city. And Brian is on the edge of the group, which is obviously because he died before they shot that scene. He would be right next to every time they've done one of those group scenes looking out over something in any of these other movies, it's always Dom and Brian next to each other. And with that, he only has one line in the scene, again, because he's not around to say what his lines would have been. And that scene is really, really wooden. And I think because it lacks the jokes that it could have had and the comfort it could have had with Brian in it, you know, physically. And there's also after the three building jump, which Paul Walker is very much alive for most of it. It's that last thing where they, I think what they did was they shot all of that stuff that they had to practically, what they could, and then saved all the effects for when they got back to LA to do the studio work on the soundstage. Because when Vin looks out over that window at the end of that sequence after the supercar falls out and all that, and he turns back to Brian and says, "You still miss the bullets, Brian?" And we cut to Paul Walker just lying there, like smiling, and just doesn't say anything, you know?
Yeah.
Because, you know, because they couldn't have done it passively, I assume. And those are the types of moments that this movie would, like, those would have been potentially funny moments that are just that you just don't have the opportunity to use in this movie, you know?
Yeah, and you don't know what that line would have been because it might have been a very kind of natural ad lib, but we just don't get that.
And it might have been a terrible line, you know, but it definitely would have been a line, you know? And it's just weird that Brian just doesn't say anything.
There, you know? Yeah, something we could say with the dialogue in these movies, they would have been lines.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about Justin Lin's departure and the new director for this one, if you want.
Okay.
You like Justin Lin overall, right?
Yeah, I remember. Like I said, I think Tokyo Drift is, I mean, it's no, you know, no masterpiece or anything, but I thought at the time it was underrated, and I mean, I haven't seen it since. But I enjoyed it and thought the, especially in contrast to the way Too Fast, Too Furious approached its racing, there was a lot of practical stuff in Tokyo Drift, which really just sort of helped ground the movies. And do you remember the first trailer for Fast and Furious? Sorry.
No.
Okay. So there's an extended sequence right off the top, and it's just a guy chasing another guy through the streets of what we eventually find out to be LA. And it's about a minute long, maybe slightly less. And the reveal at the end of the scene is that Paul Walker is the guy chasing the other guy. And it's like, oh, Paul Walker's back in the Fast and Furious franchise because him and Vin were back. But that first opening minute of that trailer was just a really, really great chase sequence. And I was like, holy shit, this guy might be a good director. I didn't like the fourth Fast and Furious movie, but that sequence still worked in the movie. And, you know, there were these little things in the third movie that made me be like, this guy might be good, but, you know, I don't have my hopes too high. And then Fast Five is fucking amazing, you know? And yes. It's just, and it's only because, like, the things that they do in those movies, and in Fast Six, there's a lot of this as well. We always talk about sort of the geography of an action sequence, and Justin Lin just has this understanding of when you shouldn't cut away from the action sequence to the other little action sequence that you also have going on. And
the like B plot of the action sequence.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. 'Cause you know, that's just how action sequences work now. It's that one sequence isn't, you know, you've got to have a little thing going on within it to cut to, just to sort of keep things moving. But Justin Lin was always good at picking his spots. And when he did do his craziest set pieces, say the first set piece in Fast Five and the last set piece in Fast Five, you don't get cutaways from that. You're just in it, and the momentum is allowed to build until at the end of the sequence and at the beginning of Fast Five, Paul Walker and Vin Diesel are just jumping off that car and falling into the water. And you're just like, what the fuck is happening? And it's just this moment of wonderful release, right? And it's the same with Vin using the NOS in the safe and everything at the end of Fast Five, because there's such a build to that moment that you're just like fully sucked into the scene. And there was still, you know, holding to that for the most part in Furious Six, but Fast Seven, I think there are some big mistakes along those lines where they cut away from things that they shouldn't cut away from, or don't let momentum build, and it's really problematic, I think.
Okay.
There was no action sequence in Furious Seven that I loved. They were really close with one.
The mountain one?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the strongest one too. But I never, like, there was never that that moment, you know, in throughout this entire movie where it doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to be that elevated, but I just mean it never had that moment of like, oh, okay, I'm watching a really, really well-made action movie right now.
Yeah, and you know what that moment would have been? It would have been right after, like, the shot of Brian lying on the ground immediately at the end of the sequence. But the thing that they do 100% incorrectly, because that is a really well-designed sequence, the whole bus jump thing, I think that's very cool. But the thing that they do that is idiotic is after Brian makes that jump and grabs onto the car, they cut to the bus exploding. Like, we give a shit about the bus at all. And it takes us out of the moment of Brian doing this continued stunt, right? And we get to keep thinking about that until he's on the ground. And it would have been, there's that silent jump, you know, like they always do the jumps in this movie. All the sound has to go away. Yeah. And then we see him catch on. And it's this really cool shot. And it's a really cool idea. And then you just ramp up the sound right there and go back from slow motion. And he ends up on the ground. And it's just like, what the fuck just happened? You know, but instead they cut to a bus explosion that nobody needs to see. We've all seen a bus explode before.
And it's so implied, you know, like, of course the bus is going to fall and explode. And after you watch the trailers for this movie, you know, they use that one a lot because, as you said, it is a pretty cool idea for an action sequence. But when you watch that trailer, you want to see that whole sequence. You want to see that put together and you want to see everything and not just the 15 seconds of it. And they really do kind of cut it like more of a trailer, like, oh, here's this thing, but then there's also the exploding thing, and then he's back here. And they never really let that moment kind of breathe and be treated as like a whole piece.
Yeah, the thing in general that I hate about the way this movie was made, I think it just sort of lacks confidence. And I have like, just in its ideas, like, you know, we're obviously comparing it to Fast Five. And, you know, maybe this movie would have had the same problems even if Justin Lin had been the director. And because Paul Walker dying is a big, big thing. Like, you can't, like, that would have affected every element of production in some way. Even editing the sequences that he was alive to shoot after he's dead. You know, like, it would affect everything, top to bottom.
It has to be treated a lot differently with that, with knowing that fate, right?
Exactly. And so maybe Justin Lin, you know, maybe James Wan never had a chance, right?
Yeah. We're not James Wan killed Paul Walker truthers.
No.
This isn't his fault.
No, exactly. But something like, you remember in Fast Five, early in Fast Five, when Brian and Mia, after the train sequence, are first going to the favelas to live with Matt Schulz, whatever his character's name was. And there's this really nice, like, Spanish guitar music cue that is present in Furious 7 as well. But they're just driving in the car together, and there's just a jump cut of their drive. And it's just like this weird thing that exists in the Fast Five of just a shot of Paul Walker driving and then a jump cut and the exact same setup, but there's just a cut and it's not weird, or it is weird that it works. And it's also weird that anybody would try it. And it's just this really nice moment of filmmaking in the middle of the craziest action movie in the world. It's like, it's a Godard cut in the middle of Fast Five. And Justin Lin had those type of ideas. And when he added an unnecessary edit, it was weird and interesting, as opposed to this movie where it does a lot of things that are kind of just immediately hack moves to me. Anytime you cut to black in the middle of a scene and like cut to black, bring image up, cut to black, bring image up, cut to black, bring image up, which they do a handful of times in this movie, that's a hack move. Like that is for somebody that thinks, is the audience bored here? Okay, cut, 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 you know? And when they first, where did they get to in the end of like a montage of we're arriving here, and then they just cut, cut, cut in like five times, like zooming in via cut and blowing the shot up. And
I think that was when they got to Dubai.
Yes, that's 100% correct. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, every time they do a new sequence in this movie, they kind of give you that montage. Like, I mean, it's a movie that it's a very globe-trotting franchise. I mean, we do get introduced to new places all the time, new locations, and you do kind of get like, here are the cars, here are the girls, here are the cars, here are some people partying, here are the girls again. Like, it's not as though that idea is a new one to this series. It just can be treated differently.
Yeah, exactly. And I like the montage. I like montages. You got to have a montage. Everybody loves a montage. But you've got to do them well. And I think there's a lot of things in this movie that I've seen done well that just aren't done well in this movie, like those montages. And I think the clearest example is the introduction of the movie, where we see Jason Statham in the hospital and we get that reveal that he sort of fought his way in. And that idea is cool. The setup is cool. It's edited by a person that is terrified that their ideas are not correct. You know, and that it really upsets me when somebody's mind is like in filmmaking, as much as filmmaking can like really upset me. You know, you were sitting next to me. It's not like I cried when I saw this thing. But it just bums me out when somebody has a good idea and it's clear that it's a good idea, but does not have the confidence to execute it properly, you know, simply because they're worried that it might not be right.
Yeah, I like that sequence a lot more than you did. And you tend to have more problems with film.
Edited by a garbage man.
Choices, and I kind of just like the writing and the ideas and things. What about that really exuded a lack of confidence for you? Because I thought that was really funny. I mean, we always know Jason Statham and the villains in these movies are going to be completely over the top and ridiculous. I like the idea of kind of the reveal, you know, as he leaves the building, we just see more and more bodies and he's still killing people who somehow have survived his wrath up until this point. Mm-hmm. I don't know where we disconnect on that scene because I know I liked it more than you did.
It's just because there's all these ramp ups of speed, ramp up of speed, ramp down of speed, and all these like quick zoom in, quick zoom out, all these things that like just have a steady cam following Jason Statham through the wreckage of that hospital. You don't have to speed it up and turn it into a fucking music video, you know?
Yeah.
Because Jason Statham's one of 20 people in the world that could probably pull off that steady cam shot in a charming enough way with no words that you would still want to watch it, you know? Like, and then that is another problem I have with this movie. This movie has a fundamental misunderstanding of Statham, and that really, really bothered me too.
How so? Because I thought they did Jason Statham in general is someone who I don't know of anyone I can see who is more entertaining when looking bored by everything around them.
No, I agree. But the thing that they do with Statham, and it's kind of just a part of the way...
Jason Statham, we should say, for everyone.
Yeah, of course. the thing that they do is they kind of turn him into a, you know, this menacing bruiser, which is nobody's favorite style of Statham. You know, like... Nobody wants that Statham as their ideal Statham. They would like the agile, charming Statham. And it's too bad that they had him fighting Vin instead of, say, Brian. You know, have him fight somebody that's agile instead of having him fight Vin Diesel.
Well, he fought The Rock.
Yes, exactly. And that's the thing. That fight is good. And you know why that fight's good? Because it's two agile, athletic people fighting each other. And contrary to what Vin Diesel might think, he is not an athletic man. He doesn't move quickly. And that really hinders that fight sequence. Whereas The Rock is obviously a giant and a strong man, but he is still, for his size, phenomenally agile, you know? And that's the thing that's great about Statham at his best, is that he's graceful and strong, you know, and there's no grace to whatever his character's name is, you know. Shaw. It's Shaw. It's always Shaw now because they're always brothers.
Deckard Shaw.
Deckard Shaw. There we go. That's a pretty good villain name, actually.
That's a great villain name.
Yeah.
Pretty sure it's a Blade Runner reference too.
Yeah, definitely.
You can see Blade Runner throughout this entire film.
Yeah, Harrison Ford's in the background of 40% of the shots. Nursing his broken ankle.
Right. Also the Vin Diesel Jason Statham scene also suffers from a terrible decision on how to end that and poor dialogue choices.
Hey, Jim, the street always wins, all right?
Oh, that was so bad. Even for a closing line of a fight in an action movie that is from a ridiculous series, I thought that was exceptionally poor.
Yeah.
Like the line and just the stomp of the ground that works perfectly and stops right in front of him. I didn't like that very much at all.
Yeah.
How did you feel about him staying alive though, Shaw?
Good. I hope he stays alive until a director who understands how to use Jason Statham comes to the franchise.
Okay. Well, speaking of directors, we had a bit of a discussion after seeing this movie together in a terrible city called London.
You mean the first second of the credits when I leaned over to you and said I miss Justin Lin the most?
And later on in the day, you were just talking about how...
how London is a garbage town built of garbage people, apparently.
That and you just don't want big directors to ever deal with franchises again. Can you extrapolate that point for me a bit?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's just... I'm dealing with this minor emotional crisis right now where David Robert Mitchell, who directed It Follows, which is in theaters right now, and is very good. I liked his first movie as well. It's The Myth of the American Sleepover. Try and come up with a title of a movie that sounds more more appealing than that to me, you know?
The Chicken Fingers of American Sleepover.
Yeah, there you go. Starring Plum Sauce. But It Follows is out in theaters now. It's very good. It's very well directed, and it's a good horror movie. And it has made enough money on a very clearly shoestring budget that people, like, he's going to be allowed to make a sequel if he wants. And he seems to want to make a sequel. And I want him to make more movies. I want him to have more ideas that are unrelated. I don't want more... related ideas. You know, I want to know what he follows up a teen movie, like standard teen movie, but like kind of a drama style with a weird horror movie that's about survival. And I want to know what the next idea is, not the next idea in the It Follows idea. You know what I mean? And admittedly, this stands in stark contrast to how I used to feel. But I also used to be an idiot. So, whereas, you know, like 10 years ago, you know, Batman Begins would have come out 10 years ago, this summer. And the second Batman Begins ended, I would have been like, holy shit, I cannot wait to see Christopher Nolan's follow-up to this. Which would still be the case if I saw Batman Begins for the first time today. But I wouldn't hope as hard that he makes it, you know what I mean? And there's just been this really big switch to franchises to the point where it seems like every director makes a smaller movie to get to their bigger movie, like Jordan Vogt Roberts, who made The Kings of Summer that I liked a lot. Rian Johnson, who is probably like the foremost, mid-2000s young director. You know, he's the superstar of that very, admittedly very small class, and now he's doing Star Wars. It's just those types of things where I just want these directors to be able to do different ideas instead of... different ideas that still have the same structure as all the other directors' ideas. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but I mean, we saw how well Dark Knight turned out in your opinion.
Yeah, exactly.
Well. But so, don't you have any value in the idea of a director's consistent vision over more than one movie? Like, is the idea that he made one good movie in a franchise? Now he can't do that? Now he can't continue to explore those same ideas? Or you just don't want to see someone who's good come into a franchise because there's more money to be made?
Exactly. I don't want – I don't like it, like how directors seem to now really have their eyes on the blockbuster prize, you know? And that's just a way I feel about the way movies have been moving, like away from – more interesting ideas to more related ideas that make a lot of money, you know? Whereas I certainly, I would have liked Furious 7 exactly the same amount, had it made $0, or I guess $9 for my ticket. But, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I get it. I feel like, and maybe this is just my understanding of your argument, that that's more of a backlash to the too many franchises.
Yes, 100%. It definitely is.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I don't like the idea of every time I hear about any franchise or any standalone film that has made money and then getting every executive they can get their hands on in a room and saying, how do we turn this into the Avengers? Like, mm-hmm. How do we make 10 side projects that we can have two movies every summer and make a whole universe out of this one thing? But I do love the idea that, like, of a Christopher Nolan James Bond, or like I do really like the idea of someone who we know is a talented filmmaker getting their take on something big. And you just seem to have like no interest in that. And I get that your argument is like, would you rather see a good director's take on something okay, or would you rather have that director have complete power to do anything they want and have a completely wholly original idea? But I just don't know that that's possible either.
I mean, using the example that I used in that specific conversation where we were talking about the Nolan Bond movie, you know, my argument was that if the trade-off is he makes that Bond movie instead of Interstellar, I'm taking Interstellar every time. Now, admittedly, Nolan's movie is not going to be next movie is not going to be made with the freedom of Interstellar. I still
just because of how that went, or
yeah, it didn't make enough money to like the things he was able to get away with in Interstellar are amazing and wonderful, and he won't be able to do that again until one of his movies is a Christopher Nolan sized hit again. He'll be able to make his next movie and have his own ideas for it, but I don't think there's going to be $200 million waiting for him. Yeah, even say, you know, we're coming off Interstellar, whatever Nolan's next movie is, I would rather see it than him doing Spectre. You know,
how about Fast and Furious 8 by Christopher Nolan?
I don't have a response for that because
you would see it so many times.
Oh yeah, I definitely see it. But here's the thing, like in all of these scenarios, the end product is still a Christopher Nolan movie. So I'm still going to see it a bunch of times, you know?
Right.
Just because he's good at making everything. My thinking is that the highest returns would come off of him making something new, you know?
Yeah. And I think what, we kind of said was that, it's great that Rian Johnson has all of this money to put his ideas in, you know, doing the newest Star Wars, but it just comes with a pretty strict leash. Like, yes. He's definitely going to make some cool stylistic choices because that's what Rian Johnson does. But there's also a checklist of 400 things he has to accomplish in this movie that really restrict the idea of him having freedom and him being the sole filmmaker just because of how much money and legacy is tied up in a franchise.
Exactly. And that said, I think I feel like J.J. Abrams will be a pretty good protector of Rian Johnson's talent and allowing him to get away with some things that he maybe wouldn't be able to get away with in like the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And
yeah,
I think that
sure.
I'm much happier that he's doing a Star Wars than I would if he was doing, I don't know, Ant-Man or something. Right.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, in this, you know, not best case scenario, it's still not the worst case scenario. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Do we want to talk about, I mean, we said everyone loves a montage earlier. Do we want to talk about the most notable montage of this movie, which is the
getting the gang together montage?
Oh, I meant saying bye to one of the members of our gang.
Oh,
montage.
Yeah. Well, we haven't. Well,
okay.
I want to.
Well, you can save that for the end because that's very much an end.
Yeah,
note.
Exactly. I got the Wiz Khalifa song all queued up and everything. No, the one thing we didn't talk about with Statham, because, you know, I leaned into it, that nobody's favorite Statham is the menacing Super Statham that we get in this movie.
Why was Crank so good?
I don't think that's okay. Well, I mean,
he's pretty super in that.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm not crazy about Crank, you know.
Oh yeah, you're a Crank 2 high voltage guy. I
never even saw Crank 2. So yeah. Okay. But you know, the Statham that is, because he's a funny guy, he's a charming guy, he cracks jokes, and this movie misses a charming, funny guy for those things that we talked about, Han being written out of the series, and Paul Walker's death. And this movie...
And I thought The Rock was also less funny. Like, he's funny when he gets his jokes, but because he's one of the, like, the funniest people going in mainstream Hollywood for my money.
Yeah. He's just not in a lot of the movie because he's shooting Hercules.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I mean, in this movie, he's basically Chekhov's rock. You show it to Dwayne in the first act and use it in the third, you know?
You know, he was watching football footage of himself?
Yeah, we talked about this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's so good.
Which is funny. But yeah, and that those things, like the lack of a charming Statham and the lack of The Rock and the lack of Han and the lack of Brian, and I think that takes away some of the fun of the movies. And yeah, I think that's... that's just sort of the button on my Statham should have been charming thing. Right. It would have let him do what he's best at and made his fight sequences less laborious, and also just made this movie more enjoyable, you know, more fun. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
There are some, like, I do want to point out some good things that this movie does, though, because there are.
The Rock calling people woman.
Yeah.
Bringing a sledgehammer to a graveyard.
Great. That's
super
a
tasteful.
Oh, that I know we both laughed when we saw it, but that tracking shot away from him standing mournfully by himself at Letty's half grave holding that sledgehammer, so funny. And he seems to just have the sledgehammer with him at like four different points of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, that moment is one of those ones that is supposed to have weight, like the footage of the wedding between he and Letty, where he's wearing his wife beater as well, like,
and his finest white jeans.
Yeah, let's get over the like literal significance of wearing a wife beater to a wedding as groom. Like, not super promising.
No, it's Groot. He is Groot.
He is groom. We are groom, actually. Sorry, I cut you off there, though.
No, I don't remember what I was talking about. Okay. My killer Groot joke landed, so that's all I need.
It certainly did. How did we not make that one yet?
I don't know.
Good stuff.
Yeah. But good things in this movie.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah. There are some very cool moments when in that I think the Brian sequence, as he's trying to get the repeater on for God's Eye so Hacker Girl can hack or whatever Ramsey. That point is. Ramsey, that's her name. I was trying to think of it all day. And I didn't have access to the internet, apparently. But, you know, the villains cut off my internet and I couldn't get a repeater going. But that sequence with Brian is good. I like his fight sequence with Tony Jaa on the stairs. I think that part's cool. But the thing I like the most is when he's kind of cornered and we see him look over to see that cart on wheels, right? And we see him see this cart and then we cut to his enemies and then we see him using it. So we see the thought and then we see the action immediately following it. And it's a cool, cool moment. And it's not like it's never been done. But it's just sort of that execution that where this movie fails so much that it just kind of nails it. And the first hot potato switch is really great because we get that really cool thing, right? Where they pass Ramsey from car to car. Well, what's that? That thing where you like spin in a car. I don't know. Are they drifting? What's that called?
Fishtail, probably.
Fishtail. Yeah, that sounds about right. But they're like fishtailing right next to each other and passing Ramsey from car to car. And then right out of that, there's a missile following them at the moment. And we get Brian still in his car and we get Brian rolling out of his car. And then we get Brian's car exploding. So it's all of these, like, it's these three cool things back to back to back. And they're all within the same momentum of the scene, right? It's not. Brian jumping from that bus is cool. Brian making that catch is cool. This bus exploding is cool. And Brian sticking the landing off the car is cool. You know, like one of those three things does not fit.
Yeah, there's not just a straight line between those things. Even though it's all over kind of one incident, it's not, you know, it's not a perfect thread that you can watch and enjoy.
Yeah. Yeah. And just as far as like a nicely directed moment, I thought the house explosion, I thought that was cool. And I thought, Brian closing the door, despite, I think, the way explosions work and the way minivan doors work is pretty much impossible. But I thought his head hitting the glass was cool. And
yeah, I thought that was really cool.
And the way I thought the way characters look around, pretty much, I don't know, just sort of the aftermath of that sequence, the way Mia just totally ignores Dom and looks to Jack, and Brian immediately looks to Mia, and just the whole like who everybody looks at first sort of thing, I thought was really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the tooling up montage, if you will. That was well done.
Right. So with that sequence you're talking about with the kind of passing Ramsey around.
Hot potato
to avoid God's Eye. Does that make any sense?
Who cares, man?
Okay.
No, it doesn't. But my problem with this movie is not that it doesn't make sense. It's that within the nonsense, there's no like I don't know, coherent thought, which I suppose is kind of the definition of nonsense.
These sound like similar ideas.
Total lack of sense. But you know what I mean. It's that there's no thought to the nonsense. I guess that is what I mean, as illogical as that sentence reads or sounds.
Okay.
Yeah. But you know what I mean, and everybody listening to this knows what I mean.
So I know what you mean.
I think Vin listens, actually.
Me and me listening on my iPod later know what you mean.
Taking notes to improve your skills as a podcaster.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Drink more Corona by the neck.
Yeah, definitely. With your neck.
With my neck. Should we mention Kurt Russell?
Kurt Russell's in this movie.
Yeah, that's all it really takes, right?
Yeah. I mean, he's the guy that doesn't quite fill the rock-sized hole in the middle of this movie.
Yeah, I think I don't think anyone knew how well The Rock was going to work out in Fast Five. Like, this is kind of the beginning of his franchise Viagra mode kicking in. Yeah. Did you hear about Denzel being?
Oh no.
Okay, so I've trying to find a good source, and I've yet been able to. But
holy shit.
There's talk of that he was considered for a role, which he turned down, I think, is the general consensus, and he would have been the Kurt Russell character, and probably would have been fleshed out a bit if you could have got Denzel, because he is a bigger name than Kurt Russell at this point. It's safe to say. Do you think we're going to get, and not to denigrate Kurt Russell, who is surely listening, do you think we're going to get a real actor in this franchise soon? I know Denzel's not just doing nonstop art house films or anything, but I put him in a tier above Kurt Russell for sure at this point in their careers. And it's just interesting to me because this franchise is getting a ton of traction, and everyone knew that this movie was going to make a ton of money, and it made a ton and a half of money, and still gets like well reviewed. And as I said earlier, like, I think people want to see if Fast Five was a fluke, and it wasn't. I still think it's better, but I still think, like, in the previous two and three, if you want to count Fast Five, they've proved that, like, they can do something with this, and this can go for a while. This, no matter how bad the next one is, they're gonna, like, they have enough steam for three more big budget movies.
Yeah.
And especially because of where they release it in the year, like, it's kind of a summer half tentpole movie. That's a spring tentpole movie.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And again, this one would have come out in the summer had Paul Walker not died, and it would have made the same amount of money, probably. Actually slightly less probably, but,
Yeah, I think less.
Yeah. Because of the curiosity around the death and all that stuff.
Like, what do you think about the future of this franchise, I guess, in general? We've lost Paul Walker, but we've lost him before. But, I mean, we've lost him for good.
I don't know. I don't know. Because part of what makes these franchises easy to contain is that you don't add those high-profile superstars, those Denzel, that's going to charge you $20 million to be in the movie, right? It allows you to put more money into the action. And obviously with the way that these characters, like, to get Vin Diesel back, it's going to be slightly more than what it took to get Vin Diesel in this movie, you know, and pretty much everybody else. But they're still comparably low-cost actors, you know?
I would say, though, that, like, you're going to get mad at this comparison. But something like Robert Redford in Captain America 2.
Yes.
Where he's just like, I mean, Robert Redford is a living legend. I know you're not going to disagree with that part of the statement. But he was someone who could always use a paycheck, like, doesn't need a paycheck, but why not? And he's at a point in his life where it's like, my kids, my grandkids are liking this stuff. I want to be in something that they're going to watch, because they're not going to watch all this Lost, and they're not going to watch all the President's Men.
Well, they should fucking watch it.
Well, I know they should, but I can see someone who has enough money taking a small paycheck to be in something popular and something that more than, you know, certain film critics are going to like, but, you know, to up their profile, to make a decent amount of money for what is probably going to be a small amount of work with maybe some fun people that you haven't had a chance to work with. Like, yeah. That doesn't sound crazy, right?
No, it doesn't sound crazy.
Okay, so I just feel like there's going to be like a Denzel or something equivalent.
I don't think it's Denzel. Denzel is bigger than you think Denzel is.
Yeah, that's why I think a comparable person would not be remotely shocking to me for the next one. And okay. I think that they're going to feel that Paul Walker's missing. They're going to know that no one talked about Kurt Russell after this movie was made. And, you know, maybe The Rock's going to get busy. So I would not be at all shocked to add some more.
Oh, yeah, of course. It all depends.
Established star power to this movie.
It all depends on The Rock. I strongly believe that. It depends on how much The Rock is in the next movie as to how they go with the other casting. Because, I mean, that's what it depended on for Kurt Russell being in this movie, as we talked about. Yeah.
Right, but that was without really full knowledge of Paul Walker being absent. Yep. Like I don't think they're going to add just a villain and a henchman to this movie and be satisfied that.
No, they need another team member.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be surprised if it's someone like oddly big.
Okay.
For what this is.
Okay.
Do you want to talk about Paul's montage now? Paul's finale, Paul's send off.
Neither of us liked it, but it made a good friend of mine cry. So, I mean,
yeah, I've heard a bunch of people crying.
I heard somebody crying behind me.
What was so bad about it for you?
Well, it's just, I mean, it's not even that it's so bad. Like, I get it. It's just, I don't feel a lot. You know, I didn't know him. So I just, it's a thing that they did for them and for their friend. And, if I died and that was how you celebrated my life, I'd be like, that's awesome. Like, all these people saw my very public sort of memorial. I mean, I would have hoped you picked a better song, but
you're not going to die. Don't worry.
I will live forever. I will be the most useless human to live for very, very long. Yeah. It's just like, I see it. I see both sides. I just thought it was, you know, overly emotional and didn't really fit in with the movie and wasn't perfectly executed or anything, but I also 100% understand why they did it, you know?
Right.
So it hurts. It, you know, it hurts the movie as a
action movie, but yeah, as part of the franchise, it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Everyone got out their white clothes and watched him drive away in a white car as we pan up to this guy.
Yes. For Paul.
Hashtag for Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Is that a sufficiently bummer note to end this podcast on?
Yeah, sure.
Just as the film did?
Just talk about how we're both dead inside and have no feelings.
I didn't say that. You said okay. That about yourself.
It's definitely true.
I bawled uncontrollably.
Yeah, I know. It was weird. You wouldn't shut up.
Well, B-A-L-L-E-D.
Yeah, James was just throwing cash up in the air during this scene.
And one mixtape all over the theater.
Yo, have you heard my mixtape? Of course not. You're handing it out for free. Of course we haven't heard your mixtape.
Broke Chris Paul's ankles with the nasty crossover in the aisle of Rainbow Cinemas.
And Leandro Barbosa lost his mind. So thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Bed, Leandro. Be sure to check back next week when we'll be talking about Casablanca. All right. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.